Hey Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. This episode concludes my conversation with Mark Hollenbeck, who is the director of the Washington State Transportation Center, called TRAC, at the University of Washington. He's been studying and advising around transportation issues in the Puget Sound region for well over 30 years. I've asked questions like, why I-5 is such a mess? Why are we building more freeway like the 509 and the 167 link-ups to I-5? Why don't we make more use of public transit and mass transit in moving people around? All this within the framework of transportation being a primary source of fossil fuel greenhouse gas, as well as other nasty stuff like fine particle diesel exhaust, which is directly associated with premature deaths, especially in low-income neighborhoods. So here we go with the second segment of my very informative conversation with Mark Hollenbeck. There's a concept called induced demand. I've come across it getting ready for this program. I think what somebody like me would call it is, well, build it and they will come. So we've got that 509 project. By the way, I think it's interesting that DOT is referring to those as completion projects. That seems like, are they really completion projects? Were those 509 and 167, those extensions they're putting on them, were those always planned, or is this just term to make it sound better?
I can't, you know, what's always? That's too big a term. Have they been on the books for a very long time? Yes. They have been on the books for a very long time, and particularly 167. I mean, it's signed as 167 all the way to the Port of Tacoma. So there's nothing new about that, really.
Yeah.
They've been there a very, very long time.
Okay. So the DOT is saying that those extensions are going to relieve congestion. So once again, I guess I'm asking you for a forecast, but I mean, is it going to?
It depends. Sure, to a certain extent. But let's lay again, certain extent. So first, let's talk a little induced congestion or induced demand, and then we'll get back to that question. Sorry, this is the professor in me. So first, there's not one thing that's induced demand. There are like three or four things that are induced demand. Mm. Okay. So how much induced demand there is a function of how much pent up demand there is. So if I build a freeway in Seattle, it will fill up really quick, right? But if I build a freeway in South Dakota, nothing happens, right? Because there's nothing happening in South Dakota, right? There's no demand for new freeway. So the build it and you will come is a function of where you're building.
Hmm. Okay.
Now, on the other hand, if you come to Seattle and build a freeway, there is lots of pent-up demand for people who already own cars who would love to have it. And so that's kind of why it will fill up. But there's lots of ways it will fill up. So when we said, hey, we're going to widen I-90 in the 1980s, and we went from a roadway that was three lanes in the peak direction, one in the off-peak direction, if you're old enough to remember that, and the only thing that kept you alive was a green and arrow or a red X above your lane, and you prayed to God you didn't die when you did it, okay? And we said, oh, we're gonna add another bridge, like it's great. And a whole bunch of real estate developers said, boy, Issaquah looks really good right now. And so the amount of development taking place in Issaquah exploded well before I-90 got built because it became so much more accessible. And so by the time they had finished building I-90, all of that development already happened, and as soon as they opened the bridge, it magically filled up, something like 40,000 extra car trips a day across the two 520 I-90 bridges, right? And so that development, it wasn't just because the bridge opened up that day, it was because they spent 10 years building houses anticipating that bridge was going to appear. And so if that growth didn't happen in Issaquah, it would have happened somewhere else, but it went to Issaquah in order to take advantage of the new I-90 facility. So it in I-90's development encouraged development in a particular place, and it induced a whole bunch of demand because it was an improvement over what your other options were going to be. All right. So that's one kind of induced demand where you and that's the growth that doesn't happen in South Dakota because nobody is looking for a place to build. The second kind of induced demand is, well, I'm currently using 99 because I-5 really sucks. And if you add two lanes to I-5, then I'm going to stop using 99 and I'm going to hop over to I-5. And I-5 might not work any better, but 99 suddenly does.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But yeah. Looking at I-5, but I-5, everybody gets a little bit faster. And again, this is this wonderful thing about reliability and what you perceive, right? That 60-minute trip might become a 55-minute trip. And people like me say, "Woo, you saved 5 minutes." And people like you go, mumble, right? Because you don't see a lot of congestion relief because people have dutifully, behaviorally switched from a less good route to a new route. And all of that volume magically appeared. If you don't remember to measure I-90 as well, it's new volume on I-5, right? And you say, "Whoa, I induced a bunch of demand." And you did, but it wasn't necessarily new travel. Third kind of demand is, you know, do I want to go to the Sounders or the Mariners? God, I have to fight I-5 traffic from Tacoma in the afternoon. God, you know how bad that sucks? Do I really want to go? Ooh, look, they added a new lane on I-5. Wow, I could go to the Mariner game. That's not such a bad thing. Yeah, I'll go to the Mariners. And that's induced demand that is akin to my Mexico trip. When you make it easier, people say, "Oh, wow, and by the way, that's good for the economy because now I'm going to do more economic activities." Whereas previously I just said, "I'm not going to the Mariner game. It's just not worth it. You know, the pain of getting there just sucks, you know, and do I really believe they're going to win? Well, they're the Mariners, you know, or whatever, you know, however you view those things." So you can induce demand by dropping those costs. You can induce demand by bringing them over from parallel roads. But there's one other one that really gets to you, and that is time of day. We call this the size of the shoulders of the peak periods. If you drive I-5 up north from Tacoma, if you leave at 5:30, you might avoid the congestion, but even at 5:30, I-5 is totally full. How many of those people do you think really want to be on I-5 at 5:30? Yeah. And so when you make this road twice as big, all the people who are going at 5:30 sleep an extra hour and a half and they show up at 7, right? And because they all show up at 7, then amazingly, you're still stuck at 7 because, as I was saying, the behavior takes advantage of that advantage. So at 5:30, yeah, it's congestion free. At 8 o'clock, not a chance. And I had a class. I taught traffic engineering, wow, this early 90s. And I was inventing a homework assignment. And I said, "Well, let's see if you can do the highway capacity manual thing. How many lanes do you need on I-5 southbound at the Ship Canal Bridge at 8 o'clock in the morning, given current capacity, and level of service B, which is as fast as you want to drive. But I'm going to help you with that. I'm going to give you a time of day curve that looks like a rural road, which means you can drive as much as you want at 8 o'clock in the morning." And so you shift all of the traffic to 8 o'clock in the morning that wants to be there. And the answer is 22 lanes. Okay, but it's one direction, 22 lanes. Of course, that does not assume you can get off the freeway at, you know, and get through the intersection at Stewart and Olive, right? There's no way. Or, you know, how do you get on the Pacific in Tacoma? It just does not, the arterials don't function. But part of that, and by the way, there's no induced demand in terms of extra traffic, because I told them what the volume was, and this was 20 years ago, right? All of that shift is because people want to go to work at 8. They don't want to be there at 5:30 in the morning. They don't want to be there at 9:30 in the morning. They'd really like to be there at 8. They want to go home at 4, right? But they travel at other times of the day because I'd rather come in early and make the commute in an hour rather than come in at 8 and do it 90 minutes. And so I go early, I stay late, I shift my behavior. And when you allow them to go back to the way they want to, of course they do. They're not dumb, right? And they have their own self-interest, sleep. I'm not going to object to sleep. You know, those are good things. And so these behavioral changes, and so when you're driving on I-5, because you're there when you want to be, you're like, "Man, it still sucks," right? And then because it works at 6:30 and 7, then people say, "Oh, I'm going to move to Puyallup. I can drive. It's not bad," right? And that encourages then more development out. And so these four different types of induced demand all play into the fact that, hey, I-5 is going to suck. And it's going to, no matter what you do to it. And so when you add pricing, now I have a reverse influence. And people go, whoa, do I really want to do this? You know, oh, okay, my employer's going to give me a free transit pass. Okay, well, I'll take the train. Yeah, it'll take me an extra 15 minutes, but I can play Wordle all the way in. I can sleep. I can do these other things. That's not so bad. Yeah, it's 15 minutes, but it beats being stuck on I-5, right? And so then your behavior changes. But if life is magic, you know, you choose different options of transit. And so that's kind of why, as we add transit, it's great for sucking up growth, but it doesn't necessarily make I-5 work. Because if I-5 worked, many people would jump back from the train because I-5 worked. Because they're on the train because I-5 sucks.
So I think I'm slowly getting a major conceptual shift here, because the shift that I'm personally experiencing is that solving our transportation problems, or if not solving, making transportation better, is about human behavior. It's not about concrete or rails or something like that. The key is how people, and I guess I have to say in our culture, because I believe there are other cultures where they view this differently, that how do people in our culture make decisions about getting from A to B, where they're going to live, and those kind of things. So is there something to what I'm getting here about behavior versus concrete?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about behavior versus concrete. I don't think it's, I mean, culture is a part of it. I don't want to underplay culture, but culture is often driven by the land use attributes and the choices that are presented to you. So if you go to the Netherlands, right, the Netherlands after World War II was basically destroyed. They started to build it in the modern 70s, you know, car-driven culture, but they ran out of land because they're the Netherlands, right? They ran out of land and they consciously said, we don't have enough land to do this. And so we're going to make it so it's easy to ride a bike. We're going to make it so it is more difficult to drive a car. We are already a small country. We're going to interplay all of these land uses. That actually fits with the 1800s, which is what we started with. And so when you're in the culture, it becomes really easy. It's designed to be really easy to ride your bike. It rains in the Netherlands as much as it rains in the Pacific Northwest. It's not about the rain. They're quite comfortable in rain gear. They have, you know, places to hang your rain gear. They have places to put your bike. They have provided the infrastructure and encouragement to make the culture work. But if they didn't have mixed land use, if they didn't have rational places to ride your bike, they didn't charge you a lot of money to drive your car. If you took someone from the Netherlands and stuck them in the U.S., they would, particularly in Puyallup or in Redmond, where I used to live, of course they drive a car because all of the signals you give them say drive a car. So we have to change the signals. I am not going to tell you you can't drive a car. No, of course, there are many things you have to drive a car for. I'm not going to say don't own a car. I'm going to say don't own four, own one, own two, right? And yes, and again, I want you to go rent that zip car, that, you know, car to go, whatever it may be, because you consciously think, ooh, I have to pay for that. Whereas once you buy a car, everything is a fixed price. Like you go to Safeway, nobody at Safeway's got free parking. What does it cost you to go to Safeway? 55 cents a mile, like every other mile. But you don't think that way. The only thing that prevents you from going to Safeway when you need to go get a gallon of milk is if you have gas in the tank. Because if you don't have gas in the tank, it's, you know, $50 right now to fill up your tank. And you think, yeah, I don't need milk, right? Other than that, it's free, right? In your brain, it's free. So, but, oh, you want to take a bus? Well, you know, we charge you $2.50 when you get on the bus. And you're like, wait, no, you know, I just take my car. It's free, but it isn't. But so if you have fewer car, like I had two cars, once my wife and I, you know, ran out of kids, we moved into Seattle. We live in a nice single family house and we had two cars and one car basically died of old age. And so I gave it to KUOW and said, great, you get money. I get a tax break, you know, great. That's cool. We have one car. I got a zip car membership. I 2 years and I never used it because I would look at it. You know, I belong to the, Paul Allen's, Flying Heritage Museum. I love to watch. I'm an engineer. I love to watch World War II airplanes fly. They're just really cool. Mm-hmm. But to rent a zip car and to drive up there for 4 hours and watch them drive, it's going to cost me like $80 worth of car rental. And even though I had my engineering spreadsheet of how much I've saved by, you know, not paying insurance and not paying maintenance and whatever, I couldn't bring myself to spend $80 of that $2,000 a year just to go watch airplanes fly around. And so I didn't make the trip. Right, that perception of me, right, drove my behavior. And so these perceptual things help us understand what these costs. The downside of when I drive costs up is I really impact low-income people because they, of course, see these costs much more heavily than rich people. We did a really cool study of 405, who used those express toll lanes. And what we saw out of 17 million transactions were 400 some odd thousand different account IDs, either a toll tag account or a driver or a vehicle license. Over 400,000 different accounts used the toll lanes in 2018. But like 48% of them used it once and only once in the entire year, whereas a very small fraction of it used it constantly. And that's actually a really good thing. What that says is there are people who don't have very much money, who don't see value, but every once in a while, they really need to get somewhere. And the interesting thing is many of the lower income tags or tags that were associated with low income areas, even though they used it incredibly infrequently, they tended to use it at the highest rates. They pay the most. And the reason was because, you know, again, I'm inventing this. They're late for daycare, which is going to close, or they're late for their job, mm-hmm. and it's 10 bucks, but they're going to save 60, or they're going to keep their job, and it's one time, and at 10 bucks, it's worth it. And that's a great thing for them. When you look at the high income, they're out there all the time. Where, why are these people out there? The general purpose lane is as fast as the HOT lane, and they're paying 75 cents, but they don't care, right? Which is fascinating. Low-income people are never out there when it's cheap, because it's only cheap because you can be in the general purpose lane. So we generated a bunch of money from high-income people because they volunteered to give it to us. You know, it's from an economic perspective, equity perspective, it's a huge win, even though we look at it and think, ooh, you know, should we do that? And so those are great signals to me, the traffic engineer, the economist. I love this mix between everybody gets an opportunity, but I want to give you some value for the money, but I'm happy to take the money of rich people who will give it to me. You know, do we need a low income card? There's lots of, but here's this, it's a balance between the signals we give, the incentives we provide, how do we deal with growth? How do we encourage people to act the right way? I don't want to tell you how you live your life, but I want to give you incentives to be nice to your neighbors, right? And so we're looking for a lot of incentives to be nice to your neighbors.
So you made a reference earlier to externalities. And of course, the negative externalities in our transportation system are greenhouse gases and small particles, basically. So do highway engineers, do they pay any attention to that? Or it's like, we just want to get people to where they're going fast.
No, they pay a lot of attention to it. But it's funny, you're only using the modern ones. We still care an awful lot about hydrocarbons and carbon monoxide, too, which come from burning those fuels, mm-hmm. right? That's what causes smog. I grew up in Southern California in the late 60s and early 70s. And when I was in high school as a distance runner, and the joke, but not a joke, was, hey, it's a good air quality day. You can see the hills 3 miles away, right? Yeah. You know, and hey, we're not in that, but it's still an issue. So yes, traffic engineers are amazingly aware of all of those. Our problem is, how do you change them? And when you change them, what other externalities? So in this part of the world, we love electric, and we're headed towards electric, and that's great because electric vehicles don't spit out those hydrocarbons. They don't spit out CO2. But the question is, how are you generating the electricity? So, you know, hooray, we've got lots of clean electricity. It's hydroelectric dams. Well, that's great, unless you happen to be a salmon fisherman, right? In which case, the externality is, by the way, we're wiping out the salmon. Or I like orcas, and the orcas are starving to death because we've wiped out the salmon. And so those trade-offs exist. Oh, we want to use batteries. Well, we need, you know, where are we getting the nickel? Where are we getting the titanium? Where are we getting the lithium? You know, who are we buying that from? What environmental damage are we doing? Is anybody recycling those batteries? So those externalities fit in where the battery concept is a really good one. EV as a concept is a really good one. But we also have to worry about these other externalities, right? And you have to put it in a place where I'm a huge fan of the business model. By the way, the business model applies to you as a human and your, how you make decisions, but it applies to governments. How do they spend their money? And it applies to businesses, because businesses only do things if they're going to get a return on those investments. If not, they spend their money elsewhere. So you actually have to have a business model that makes sense. That is, why are people going to give me money for this? Do they see value? If they don't see value, they're not going to give me money. That's really important. If you're a business, you have to do something because you're going to get more money out of the people you're doing it for than you're putting into it. And if not, I'm going to spend my money elsewhere. In the government side, it's I only have so much money and I have 10 times as much that I need to do with that money as the money I have. Which important of those 10 things am I going to do? Am I going to spend it on the homeless problem? Am I going to spend it on crime? Am I going to spend it on environmental protection? Am I going to spend it on traffic? Am I going to spend it on, you know, pick all of your topics. And so you have to constantly make a good argument. Not only is this a good thing, but it's a better thing than the other 8 things I can spend that money on. And that gets in the way of that we have to encourage that business side of all the government, the businesses and the individuals. And that's one of the things we're struggling with in the electric vehicle market is, you know, EVs cost me more. Do I really want to spend that money? That's where the tax incentive things come in. How do I make it rational for the businesses in order to build EVs? How do I make it rational to maintain and charge them? A huge aspect of this not only is the battery recycling, but it's how do we actually pay for electricity? The electricity financial system is designed around what we built in the 1950s and 60s. And if you talk to the power people, the whole the structure of how we pay for power does a really lousy job of understanding that we have all of this wind power available in Wyoming when there's not enough usage for that wind power when we generate it. So how do we pay to get that energy from Wyoming to the right place who uses it when it's available? Southern California generates more power than they need from solar during the day. What do they do with it? It's not designed to get, the system is not designed to ship that to Washington in the winter, right? But we need that financial system, but there's too many political oxes, too much money to be made from the current system. How do we change that? And you think, what's that got to do with transportation? But if you don't fix the electrical grid and how we pay for it, then you don't have the electric charging system in place for people to charge their cars. So it's so wonderfully multifaceted that when people come up and say, it's a war on cars. No, it's not a war on cars. I just can't afford to build to double deck I-5. I don't have that money. And you won't pay the $20 toll that would cost to pay for it. So leave me alone, right? Except I don't get to say that. But, you know, those are the issues. Yes, I can do that. I can lid I-5, but, you know, it's going to cost me $4 billion and you don't want to pay the toll. And I need that $4 billion to save the orcas and to, you know, rebuild this dam and to, you know, clean up the Duwamish and all the other things that I need to spend $40 on. So it's not that it's not a great idea. It's just 29th on my list of 107 priorities, and I only get to fund 6. So, you know, yeah, talk to me. You know, and yeah, that's a bit flippant, but that's a lot of what you see in the political.
Yeah, well, part of what's going on there is in setting those priorities, I think as a species, we tend to be much more interested in short-term issues than we are in long-term issues, even though if we could pay more attention to the long-term issues, we'd be better off over time. But it seems like we're almost incapable of doing that. And we're looking at some significant costs going forward. So we're getting close to the end here. I really appreciate the time you're spending with me. And so I do have one last question for you here. And so let's say that the governor calls you in and says, you got a blank slate, Mark. I want you to do something about fossil fuel pollution in the Puget Sound region. So what would you come up with?
Well, it's essentially what we're doing now. If I got more money, I would do more of what we're doing. And that is I'm a huge fan of incentives and you have to pay for them. But I also understand and support the social justice equity thing. So some of the money has to be going to help the impact of my financial incentives to do the right thing, to help the people on the low end of the economic scale, still live a good life, given that I'm imposing all these extra things on it. Then you have to look to find places where you can effectively add density in the growth that we're having, but you have to build it in the right way and you have to put the features in. So I'm very pleased that Sound Transit is, I mean, you can always argue about the details, but I'm pleased that Sound Transit is doing a lot more in housing for low, you know, maintaining affordable housing around their light rail stations. I'm really thrilled that people are looking at that. I'm a little frustrated that Federal Way put their rail station at a place that is only served by a park and ride lot and like two apartment buildings. It's not in a place where you can, and that you want to avoid, you want to try not to have those. You know, I get to yell at Sound Transit and King County Metro in that they took a lot of wonderful developable land in the Spring District and put a giant train yard in the middle of it. And they could very easily have put the train yard where the Bellevue Metro base is and then put the Metro base on top of the train yard, because the Metro base is basically a giant parking lot. You know, that you could make better decisions there, but you run into organizations, well, it's my money, not your money, and you're going to cost me money. And so if I get the blank slate, I get to kind of surmount a lot of that organizational thinking. But while doing that, you know, the problem with being a totalitarian is, you know, ultimate power corrupts, right? And so you run over the individual. You know, if you went to Ballard, you know, Ballard was this cool little neighborhood and it got swamped by growth. But yet it's still really cool. But if you're looking for it to be the old Ballard single family neighborhoods, you've lost. And so is it fair to do that? Well, in the greater community, it's good, but you have to be gentle on the people who you're impacting. So I think you can't be too abrupt, or the mitigation, or you're being too unfair to the people who are taking it in the shorts as a result of the downsides of the things you're doing. So, you know, I'm a lousy totalitarian. I try to be a nice person, not always, but I try, right? And so these changes, I love the financial incentives. I love to tax people who use absurd amounts of gas. You know, I think that's fine. Great. You know, but how you do that, you know, in order to encourage this shift from the Hummer One to, you know, the Prius, those are really good things. But, you know, that generates the, you know, hooray, we've got EVs, but now I've just trashed the gas tax and that's how we pay for transportation. So, you know, yeah, but there's a lot of yin and yang, and I'm not sure I have the yin and yang figured out.
Yeah. So as we're finishing up here, one of the things that I'm pretty sure I just heard you say is something like, well, there is no plan. There's a lot of competing sources, and where we end up, we can't really say. We don't want a totalitarian, even though that person could have a good plan. So one of the things I say at the introduction to this program is that sometimes I'm optimistic. And, you know, I guess I have to say that here too, that after listening to all of you said, which I really found intriguing, I'm somewhat optimistic, but only somewhat, you know, and it seems like it's so difficult to know how things are going to play out. So if you were doing your optimism scale from 1 to 10, what's your optimism that in the next, by let's say 2050, we're going to have vehicular emissions down to nothing in the state of Washington?
Oh, I think, not sure zero, but I think way down. Yes, very, very, very far down. Because people will always want to drive their 63 Corvette. And we should allow them to drive their 63 Corvette. So it's not zero, right? But I do think we will shift. There's a lot of momentum in that direction. And I think we will. If you've seen what we've done in battery technology since we started to care, there's a lot more coming in that respect. Again, there's a huge business. If you can figure out batteries, you can make a boatload of money. So, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more solar, a lot more electric, a lot more renewable energy. We'll figure out ways to store it. We'll figure out ways to do recycled batteries. I think you're going to see that go and go and go. I think you're going to see a change. Don't ask me how. I think we'll see a change in your electric bill so that, I mean, I would love to see it. I don't quite understand it. So that if you do your, you know, dishwasher after 10 o'clock at night, if you charge your car after 10 o'clock at night, it costs you half. You know, if I can just say that, don't you think your behavior will change? Right?
Absolutely.
And we got a lot of free energy at 10 o'clock at night because there's water coming over those dams, right?
Yep.
So the wind is blowing in Montana. So we need to change behaviors, and we should be able to do it that way. So we'll get there. How we get there politically, that's the part I don't know. I'm just a stupid traffic engineer at the university. You know, I don't have to actually be accountable to any of that. So, but I think we'll get there by 2050. All of the large incentives say you should, and democracies aren't good at short duration stuff, but eventually we get it right. And so I have a lot of faith in the United States. We will get it right. It will not be a straight line, but we'll get there. So 2050, yeah, absolutely. I think we'll have very few fuel emissions in transportation.
Well, I love finishing up on that optimistic note. It's good for me. And my thought is, well, first of all, very appreciative of the time you spent with me, Mark, with the listeners. And my thought is, let's get together in 2050 and see how we did.
I'm all for it. I love it. I may not be, in my right mind in 2050, but, I can be optimistic about that too. All right.
Yeah. Well, I'm 78, so that's over optimistic for me. So, maybe we can have a seance.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Cool. I'll settle for that.
All right. Thanks so much, Mark.
No problem. It's been fun. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Well, there we have segment two of my conversation with Mark Hollenbeck. Like everything we confront, the challenges are significant, especially given that we have spent the last 150 years of our economic history assuming that we would always have fossil fuel energy, that it would be harmless, and that we could build our cities and transportation networks based on using fossil fuel forever. I hope you found value in this conversation and some better understanding of the possible futures of Puget Sound transportation. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found at KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.